I call Senate Resources to order. This is Wednesday, March 5th. The time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Machicki, Senator French, and myself, Senator Giesel. Senator McGuire is excused today. Serving us as recording secretary is Chris Dickrell. Claire Gross is manning the telephones for us, and Lindsay Williams is staffing the committee. So, on the agenda today, we have three items. SCR 16, request governor to investigate coal resources, SB 77, big game hunting with children, and the Department of Fish and Game is back to review the Chinook Salmon Research Initiative. So, first item on the agenda is SCR 16, request governor to investigate coal. This committee reviewed the bill on Monday, and Senator Kelly is here today to add additional remarks, I think. So welcome, Senator Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to be here. Madam Chair, this may seem a little unusual, but I wanted to offer an amendment because I wasn't here on Monday. I was a little bit sick and didn't catch the flavor of the meeting. I don't know if that amendment changes the will of the committee, if it takes up a lot of your time and maybe you want to deal with it later. I am, as much as I'd like to see this voted on and moved out of committee, I would also understand if the committee wanted to hold on to it and discuss the amendment after you've got some other work done. So that's my first comment. And then if...
All right. Well, along those lines, if you would like, we will. I will move Amendment A2, Alpha 2, now. Members should have that at their desks. All right. Thank you. This amendment makes a simple change on page 2, line 5. Right after investigate, the governor... We'll start with the beginning of the sentence. Be it resolved that the Alaska State Legislature respectfully requests the governor to investigate, inserting this phrase, without regard to federal permits or restrictions, the development of a large coal plant and associated electric grid. So that is the amendment. Any discussion? Yes, Senator Fairclough.
Madam Chair, if I could ask the sponsor, could you explain what is the intent of the words?
And Senator Fairclough, through the chair, absolutely. That's kind of why I talked to you earlier, is that I don't know if you clearly understood my intent because I couldn't be here before. This bill is about, I think the grave danger we find ourselves in this state. We're hanging by a thread as far as energy is concerned. And at every juncture, we are told no. We are told you didn't say mother may I, and you got to take three steps back. When you read in the newspapers about what Vladimir Putin did in the Crimean Peninsula, Ukraine specifically, it recalls Czechoslovakia of 1938 and Poland of 1939. Events can change on a dime. Who would have thought September 11th, when you woke up, that you would find that the whole world had changed in an instant when two planes crashed into the towers? That's going to happen. Our energy prices are going to go through the roof. We're already paying kilowatt hour prices in some communities that just simply aren't sustainable. Alaskans are facing an energy poverty that's going to wipe us out. What I want this group to do is go through the thinking process that needs to take place when you're going to defy the federal government, because that's what this is about. How many years have we been hearing people say, why don't we just go drill in Anwar? Well, we can't. It's federal ground. And then if you did find some company that wanted to go out there and take the risk of a fine or tax consequences or something like that, then they've got to cross federal land and rivers and streams, and there's thousands of problems between there and delivering the oil down in Valdez. What I envision is to investigate the possibility of building a coal plant with state funds on state land to federal specifications, but without regard to federal permits. The reason that it is because so often we meet federal specifications, we do everything we're supposed to do, and then some judge in San Francisco says, man, sorry, didn't say Mother May I. Now, are we people of the rule of law? Yes, there's no question about that. But that isn't going to matter. The nuances of federal regulations are not going to matter when we simply can't afford to turn our lights or our furnaces on because the cost of energy has gone through the roof. So what I want the group to do, or what I would like the governor's, the administration to do, is investigate. Can we build a power plant on state land? And then when it's built, can we turn it on? And if we do, what will they do? And if they do that, we'll do this. Okay, yeah, but if we do this, they'll do that. And we have to figure out, to quote the Bible, before you take on something like this, you need to count the cost. And that's what this is about.
Yes. Senator Faircliff, did you have follow-up?
I did. So you're asking for a process. You're not asking to build something on federal land right now. You're asking the governor to work together to identify somewhere on state land a coal fire plant, because the rule of law is actually why I objected. I mean, even though we would like to poke the federal government in the eye sometimes, the courts might see that otherwise.
Madam Chair, the purpose of building it on state land is we don't need permission to do that on state land. If we build it on state land, the question is whether you turn it on or not. Now, that's a big question, obviously, and this is a little bit of dreaming. I get that. But the fact is, we're going to need to dream a little bit big to protect the generations of the future. If we come to that situation when we wake up and Tel Aviv is a memory and energy prices have gone through the roof, is that the time to build this power plant? Is that the time to take action to protect ourselves from an event that's coming? I don't know what it is. I mean, it may only be an economic event. But there's something going to come that's going to change energy prices once again. And the last time, it crippled Alaskans. Frankly, where a lot of you live, and certainly where I live, it's getting ridiculous. So this is taking us out of our, I would hope, no. To answer your question, Madam Chair, this is investigating a process. This isn't building a power plant. We can't do that right now. They need a lot more discussion than a concurrent resolution.
Senator Dyson has a question.
Yeah, I'm a great enthusiast for the use of our coal, and maybe the world's. On page 2, line 5, it says to investigate the development of a large coal power plant in the whole power distribution or electric generation issue. There's always the argument about distributed as opposed to centralized, and power distribution over long distance is difficult, and till the advent of DC power, high voltage DC power, was significant line loss. That's changing. But did you mean to limit this to them only considering it and do it in one place as opposed to precluding a plant up in the Northwest where there's huge coal departments, deposits, and a couple other places?
In the resolution, Madam Chair, excuse me just a moment. My apologies. I need to
come. No problem.
We do identify some places in the state, and one of them is the coal reserves up in by Kotzebue. Mm-hmm. The point is, we have the reserves. We have about half of the United States reserves to power the United States for 100 years or something. It's crazy.
It's all of North America for 300 years.
Is that what it is? And it's. It's low sulfur coal, and in fact, the coal near Fairbanks, I think, which is not even the best. I think the best is down near in Matsu. It's equivalent to the coal that meets the standard of the 1990 Clean Air Act. question was, does it envision other places? Certainly, I think that would be the purview of the group that is assembled by the governor in this resolution.
Follow-up.
Is it fair to say on the record there that is your intention as a sponsor that this not be limited to a very large plant, but proof of concept wherever it makes sense or something?
That would certainly be correct. And if I could say one more thing, Madam Chair, you had mentioned DC Power. Obviously, DC Power is a bit of a dream right now, but by the time we put all this together, I know it's moving quickly, the technology is moving quickly, we could actually hope to power rural Alaska from, say, a gigawatt plant at Mat-Su or Fairbanks or something like that, or if you could build one up in Kotzebue, you might be able to power the whole Northwest and North Slope from inexpensive coal.
Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you bringing this forward. You know, in my district, there are a lot of folks that are upset about this particular resolution. Frankly, if I can just read a couple things from your further resolve, I think it's important. I think for $75,000 worth of study, which we throw studies around the state like for things that have very little potential to deliver something of value, this is what we get to understand. I think it's our responsibility to understand these things. And we're not even talking about what we might choose to do to scrub coal emissions so that they match the emissions of a natural gas plant or something else. That's the next step. But what you're asking is that we get a report on the potential cost of coal plants from 200 megawatts to 2 gigs, the cost of a kilowatt of a coal-generated energy in comparison to other sources, the technological potential for transmission, and how a large mine mouth coal plant might help balance future needs of the state with hydro and other types. I'd like to know the answers to that question. This is not an anti-environmental thing. We've got a huge potential of coal energy lying right here, endless supply. We should understand whether or not we can use them responsibly, and I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Further questions or comments? Senator Fairclough?
Madam Chair, I'd like to remove my objection.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could offer a conceptual amendment.
You absolutely may.
Madam Chair, on page 2, line 5, after the word development of, delete A, then after large coal plant power plant, insert the letter S on the word plants. So if I might, Madam Chair, it would then read, after our amendment right now, be it resolved that the Alaska State Legislature respectfully requests the governor to investigate, without regard to federal permits or restrictions, the development of large coal power plants and associated electrical grid to provide energy to residents of the state to heat their homes and keep their lights on.
I'll object for discussion.
Madam Chair, the purpose of that is to address Senator Dyson's thought, and what I heard, at least from the sponsor of the bill, his concurrence that we could look at more than one, and that would do it. You could look at one, or we could look at others. And so I would throw it out to the sponsor.
I certainly have no objection.
Very good. I'll remove my objection. Very good. Amended a second time. Excellent. Further discussion? Great. I will just point out, in your packet, you should have the Emma Creek Coal Project, looks like a plan for such a plant there in Healy. You also have a very recent, November 13, Coal Energy and Economic Impacts of Coal in Interior Alaska. It's a McDowell Group report, also very informative. Anything else you would like to add, Senator Kelly?
Madam Chair, just what I opened with, and I was very, very concerned about the possibility of a bait and switch. Those few words could change the nature of this resolution for a lot of people. I really appreciate the committee's discussion on this. Didn't want you to think I was trying to pull a fast one or something. No.
All right. Well, I'm glad that you were able to be here. We had public comment on Monday and had some folks call in that were opposed to coal regardless, right? And one of the statements that was made was climate change is settled, and there was talk about CO2 and so forth. And in response to that, I did include a report in your packet or brought it to your offices today. It's called The Social Cost of Coal. But there's a nice illustration there that I think we forget that CO2 is plant food. The optimal level for plant growth is 1,200 parts per million. That's 1,200 parts per million. Presently, we're at 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. So for each little increment of CO2, we actually are reaping positive results in food production for us to live here. Over the last 100 years, plant growth has increased 60%. This is a good thing. We talk about climate change being a settled thing. Certainly, the climate has changed multiple times over the centuries. We had an ice age 12,000 years ago, a lesser ice age from 1560 to 1820, but we also had the medieval warming period, and that's never talked about. The medieval warming period was from 1200 to 1410 AD, and during this time, Norwegians came to Greenland, found it to be such a rich environment, they farmed and lived there for a couple hundred years. The temperature then was 2 to 3 degrees centigrade above the baseline of today. So these are important things to remember. Henry's Law states that at any given temperature, the amount of gas dissolved in solution is directly proportional to the pressure of the gas in the air above the solution. This is the ocean and CO2. As CO2 increases in the atmosphere, Henry's Law states and is proven that the amount of CO2 in the ocean also increases. So there is an automatic balancing system in our environment. And I mentioned to the folks, I think I mentioned on Monday, you know, there's a lot of advocacy for green energy, alternative energy, such as wind turbines. 3 to 5 tons of copper in every wind turbine. That is 2 solid Chevy Suburbans of copper. So to say that, coal will be the demise of the human race is just, it's exaggeration. So I did want to put that on the record because we did hear the opposite message pretty avidly during public comment. Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, a fascinating read for those on the committee that haven't read the book is the History of Weather. If you get a chance, it's an interesting book, and I do suggest folks, just for a sort of alternate philosophy, it's worth reading.
Interesting. Great. Thank you. Further comments, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. There is a lot of misinformation, and I think a lack of perspective. I can make and defend a pretty cogent argument that the Industrial Revolution could not have gone forward without coal, and that unintentionally perhaps, but coal saved the forests of Europe, and there just wasn't the energy available for the Industrial Revolution. And whatever you think about the ills that went along with it, virtually all the things we enjoy in modern life, all the machines that make life safer, and orders of magnitude impact on food production and the efficiency thereof, much of our medical science, virtually without power, we would not have been able to have the provisions of clean water and the way of treating waste. If you think pollution in cities is bad from automobiles, you should have seen or heard about what it was like with horses. And just the problem of dealing with horse manure, all smart remarks aside, was just huge and was very, very limiting and a tremendous impact on health, you know, and so on. And the list goes on and on. A little bit off subject, but I'm a mechanical engineer. I can make a pretty good case that the oil industry saved the whales, because before the oil industry, you know, sperm whale oil was a premier lubricant. And yes, we got oil from a couple of different plants and so on and forth. Lamp oil, you know, and so on and so forth. Just a huge impact. It's not a popular view that you hear very often, but back to Senator McKickey's perspective, we really do need to have a historical perspective. And I thought the response to one of my questions of public testimony, I asked the young man, sounded like a young man, if there was any amount of science and proof of the stack emissions from clean coal plants that would persuade him. And he honestly, bless his heart, said no. You know, and I think we all have to watch out that we don't come to these policy decisions with any of those kind of preconceived ideas and then deliberately, inadvertently select information that augments and supports our own preconceived ideas. End of sermon.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Further comments? Very well. Then I will entertain a motion.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 16, version 28LS1519/A as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, Senate Concurrent Resolution number 16 will pass from this committee with individual recommendations as amended, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the transmittal document. On the record, our next bill on the agenda is SB 77, Big Game Hunting with Children. Senator McChicky is the sponsor of the bill. Senator McChicky, I will let you take it from here. I see you have a couple amendments.
I do, Madam Chair, and that will get us to the CS. I'm going to ask my staff, Mr. Simmons, to join us up here, and then I'll go ahead and move Amendment A2, please, Madam Chair.
I will object for purposes of discussion.
I'm going to hand it off to my staff, Mr. Simmons, because I don't see it.
Thank you for the record, Madam Chair. Amendment 8, oh, I'm Larry Simmons, staff to Senator Michiki, sorry. Amendment A2 amends the bill on page 1, line 12, to insert, except for a Sitka black-tailed deer, where the harvest limit for the deer is one for each person. And the purpose of the amendment is to encourage youth hunting in areas where the limit is one black-tailed deer. A black-tailed deer is a small animal. And the concern without this amendment is that each hunter in a youth hunt normally has to punch their tag. So the adult and the youth hunter both have to punch their tag. Well, for a Sitka black-tailed deer, that's, in a sense, a high price to pay for a deer. So the thought here is that there would be an exception that would allow just the youth hunter to punch their tag in a youth hunt.
Very good discussion. Senator Faircliff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know whether there's opposition from the sponsor of the bill?
Well, no. I don't oppose the amendment.
Senator Kelly is the sponsor.
Perhaps we should clarify who the sponsor of the bill is. Would you do that, Senator Michiki?
Yes, I'm not sure which version you have.
We have version A, Alpha.
Okay. Of the current version, I am the sponsor. Senator Kelly has removed himself as being the primary sponsor. And I have version here that has by Senators Michiki and Kelly as a co-sponsor. So
that's the way it shows up on basis right now, but the one I have in my folder.
Madam Chair, could we have a brief at ease?
Yes, brief at ease. We're back on the record. So we've got an amendment here, amendment number A2. Is there further discussion on amendment A2? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't have an opportunity to get up to speed on this. As I understood the argument from Larry that Sitka black-tailed deer are small, and therefore it makes sense to allow both the adult and the child to punch their ticket for one. Where I spent a lot of time, Prince William Sound, the deer there, particularly on the islands, are also small. And I would hope that, and the argument there would make the same amount of sense, I think. But I'd just like some consideration that to see if the Sitka black-tailed deer includes the group in Prince William Sound. I will not stop the bill for that. If there's somebody here from Fish and Game that could tell us, I would appreciate that.
There is someone from Fish and Game here. Mr. Doug Vincent Lang will come forward, Director of Wildlife Conservation.
Thank you for inviting me up to the table. I'm Doug Vincent Lang, Director of Division of Wildlife Conservation. This issue regarding Sitka black-tailed deer came up at a board meeting about a year ago. And when the board was trying to create a youth hunt for deer in Prince William Sound outside Cordova, one of the main issues that the public raised was, well, I didn't want to be able to go out hunting with my son or daughter and have that count against me for a small animal like deer that are numerous. So the board in that case kind of exempted Sitka black-tailed deer from the rule. So this would allow them to do that under this regulation rather than doing it under hunting heritage, is where they kind of got to with with that hunt in Cordova. So you're correct. Those are Sitka blacktail deer that are there.
All right. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Michiki, did you have an additional comment?
Just wanted to point out that they're the same species.
Okay, great. Wonderful. All right. So I will remove my objection then to Amendment A2. Senator Michiki, you have an additional amendment, I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment A3.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
I'm going to describe the amendment and hand it off to my staff again. Amendment A3, page 1, line 5, deletes the word may and replaces it with the word shall. Mr. Simmons.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Larry Simmons for the record.
Yes, go ahead.
The purpose of this is to leave the statute the way it is now, which is to read, For the purpose of encouraging adults to take children hunting, the board shall establish annual hunting seasons in appropriate areas of the state, and so on. Now, if we changed it to May, some would read this, perhaps at some future time, to sort of give the board the option. And we think that the intent of this whole section is to more than just encourage the board, but rather to, in a sense, direct the board, just the way the statute is now. So,
okay. That's great. Further discussion or questions? Senator Dyson, did you have a question?
I'm really glad you did it, because the previous edition, the A version here, had changed it, and I was very confused how you were accomplishing your goal with that. Thank you.
Any other questions about Amendment A3? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. So we have the full bill before us then as amended. Any further comments or questions for the bill's sponsor or staff?
Well, Madam Chair, if I can kind of describe the bill, and then I'm going to hand it off to my staff again.
Great. Senator Michiki.
We live in a state that has enjoyed a rich history of with the subsistence social and cultural events of hunting, and the best way to hand off those traditions safely is to accompany young people in their first hunts. This allows adults to effectively train young people in the proper methods of harvest taking care of meat, gun safety, that sort of thing. So with that, I'd like to pass it on to my staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Larry Simmons. So the purpose of the bill is to grant the board more flexibility in establishing youth hunts. That's the primary. It removes some timing requirements that are in the law now, giving the board better flexibility. And then secondly, we've already talked about it, the Sitka Blacktail Deer Amendment would allow families to harvest two deer in situations where otherwise, if we didn't put that amendment in there, they would only be allowed to harvest one.
All right, great. We have a couple people online who would like to testify on the bill. So I will open public testimony. The first person is Peter Probasco in Palmer, ADF&G Board of Game. Mr. Probasco, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, loud and clear. Thank you.
Great. So if you would identify yourself for the record and then give us your testimony on SB 77.
Yes, I am Pete Probasco, and I am from Palmer, and I'm a member of the Board of Game. My comments, of course, apply to me as a member of the Board of Game and not necessarily for everybody's on the board. But this Board of Game does strongly support youth hunting. We think it's a very vital issue. I specifically like this bill because it brings it into a real focus on the significance of getting youth out into the field. I've been involved in youth activities in the field and with safety for many years and think it's very, very important. And the more we can do with our young people, they are our future. And I think this bill is very significant. We recently passed a antlerless moose hunt for youth, where 20% it's North Fairbanks, 20% of the permits will go to youth hunters. And the first year on, that's going to mean 78 youth will specifically get a youth permit. And I think that's a very good thing, and this legislation is going to give us much more flexibility in establishing other youth hunts. And I compliment all of you that are involved in sponsorship of this bill. I like Senator McKeeke's sponsor statement about the bill, in which he specifically says that the bill will give the Board of Game more flexibility to establish youth hunts. And I'm sure we'll do that. And I thank you and give my full support to this effort.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Probasco. Any questions from the committee members? Great. Thank you very much. The second person who is online to testify is Teresa Sager Alba from Mataska Pass. Mataska Pass, pardon me. Teresa, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Great. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Madam Chair, my testimony is 3 minutes. Is that acceptable?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Teresa Sager Alba. I live in the Eastern Interior on the Toke Cutoff near Mentasta Pass, and I'm testifying on Senate Bill 77. I serve as a member of the Board of Game, and I am testifying in my own personal behalf. Since the law to encourage adults to take children hunting was created, the Board of Game has been frustrated in failed attempts to comply with the statute. Creating youth hunts that occur before school starts and before regular hunting seasons begin can be logistically difficult or inadvisable for a number of reasons. As such, the Board has not consistently created youth hunts annually as required. Changing the annual youth hunt requirement from shall to may is one of the key provisions that inspired the Board's support for SB 77. It's my understanding that your committee may decide to retain the term shall as it appears in current statute. Please consider that even if the strict season date requirements that are removed, which is certainly advisable, the requirement to create youth hunt seasons annually has significant implications. To put this in context, our hunting regulations currently provide special hunts with special seasons, bag limits, or both for a number of different groups, some of which include youth, the disabled, bow hunters, muzzle loaders, community hunters, and Tier 2 hunters. I'll stop short of sounding the alarm bells, but I would urge you to carefully consider the impacts of the Board establishing at least one new youth hunt in Alaska every year. When coupled with the numerous other special hunts that are provided to various user groups, I think it's mathematically certain that at some point in the future, the harvestable surplus of game will be fully allocated to select classes of hunters. Please also bear in mind that adults have always had the option of taking children hunting under regular seasons and bag limits, and this will not change regardless of SB 77's final outcome. I say this not to discourage its passage, but to offer some perspective on whether we need mandatory annual creation of youth hunts. Thank you, Senators Machicki and Kelly, for sponsoring this bill, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Teresa. Questions for Teresa?
Just a comment, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
The May portion of this bill does not require the creation of annual youth hunts. I just wanted to point that out.
You changed it to shall.
Right.
Right.
It does not require annual creation of youth hunts. I'm sorry about using the word may. For the purpose of encouraging adults to take children hunting, the Board shall establish annual hunting seasons. The Board still has the availability when there's not game. I mean, that's their ultimate responsibility to. Obviously, the intent of the bill is not to create an expectation that there will be game available in areas that are challenged with population issues.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. And woman just testifying, I caught the implication from the way she stated that it was that the Board would have to come up with a new one every year. Mm. And I don't think the law here requires that. It can just reauthorize the same sort of agreements year after year in the areas where it's appropriate. And if it isn't because of shortage of game, they are not forced to do it where that, but indeed they can create a new one or 30 new ones at their request, at their discretion.
Ms. Alba, are you still there?
Yes.
Could you, I thought I heard you say a new hunt every year also. Could you clarify?
That was the, yes, Madam Chair, that was the intent of my remarks. If the interpretation, if the legal interpretation of the language as it has just been explained is that it would not require a new hunt to be established each year, then that's certainly acceptable in my view.
Thank you for clarifying that. Senator Fairclough has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Teresa, lots of times we pass laws and the department writes regulations that sometimes interpret the intent of the legislative body differently. So have you been being pressed with somehow not complying with regulation, or have you been told that this language mandates something that we're not aware of?
It has been, I'm sorry, through the chair, it's been brought to my attention a number of times by members of the public that the board is failing to comply with the statute as it's currently written due to not adopting youth hunts each year that comply strictly with this particular statute, and that the hunts that we've been adopting have been created under the statutory authority that's a little broader that says to promote and preserve the heritage of hunting and trapping.
Madam Chairman?
Yes, Senator Fairclough, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if we could have Fish and Game join us and see if we need to put out a bulletin to interpret the statute or if there's any regulation that's causing confusion.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Vincent Lang.
Hello again. Through the chair, Senator Fairclough. You got to remember this statute's been on the books for many years, and we've had now, I think, 5 or 6 youth hunts created. So I wouldn't say that it's fair to say that the board has to create them. I think the key words in inappropriate areas, and that they shall consider creating those in appropriate areas. So in a fully allocated hunt, they may decide that that's not an appropriate area for a youth hunt. So I think there's a lot of discretion. The main issue that the board has struggled with the creation of youth hunts is the earlier start season for schools. You know, it start date for schools. It's now sometime in the middle of August, in some areas in late August, and that's just too early to have a meaningful youth hunt. And cleaning up this language to allow, you know, a youth hunt to occur on a weekend, a Labor Day weekend, or some longer period of time in the fall, you know, when most hunts occur, is going to give the board a great deal more flexibility in addressing these issues.
Thank you, Vincent Lang. I think you pointed out the deletion of some significant language there, which we hadn't really explored, which we're deleting, that are open before, this is referring to hunts now, that are open before school start in the fall and before regular hunting season begin. Probably should be begins, but that deletion is what you're saying makes this much more flexible.
Yes, the main problem we have as staff in Fish and Game is looking for those hunt opportunities that occur across the state to bring to the board as opportunities under the statute, and we're really struggling when we have, you know, especially in the Anchorage area, when we have most of our moose seasons in September, October, and, you know, we have to provide a youth hunting season by the statute, you know, before like August 20th, and that's really hard.
Okay, that helps a lot. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So those, we're reading the bill. We understand you're removing that language, but it seems to be that there may be some misunderstanding in the general public about what the board is supposed to be doing. And so I was wondering if a bulletin could be issued so that at least this conversation is reflected, that there isn't anticipation of creating new annual hunts. I'll yield to the sponsor.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Senator Machiki.
There's nothing in this language that requires the creation of an annual hunt. It's only the language is such that it says that they will be created in appropriate areas of the state. And, you know, folks misunderstand things. I hear what you're saying, and I appreciate your concern for the misunderstanding. However, If we were to try to address every misunderstanding under the code, I think we would be very, very busy. And I'll, Madam Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Lang to answer. But I think it's clear, my understanding of this code is clear that it does not require the creation of a hunt unless excess animals are available for harvest.
Through the chair, it would be my intent as a director to bring opportunities to the board to fulfill the obligation to look at creation of youth hunts across our state. In those areas where the board determines that they're not appropriate, and there's going to be many areas of the state where that is not appropriate, they may not create any in a given year. They may actually get rid of some that are causing significant allocation issues or conservation issues. So it would be my intent just to use this as I shall bring forward some opportunities for the board to consider, you know, to passing on our hunting heritage as we move forward in time. But it's up to the board to decide whether they're appropriate and whether or not they would act upon creating an allocation for them.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the people of Alaska were looking at youth hunts and going to your website, would they find anything there?
They would find them in our hunt supplements. That's where we would probably see them in our hunting regulations. They probably wouldn't see them on our website, and that's actually a good point. I should probably create a website that has, or a specific portion on our website that has youth hunting opportunities. We have a hunter education program. The other thing that we've been doing with most of these youth hunts is the board has been adding on a requirement that anybody that is able to draw one of these permits or come in for a registration permit has to have hunter education. So this would be a nice follow-through to our hunter education program, saying here's a couple of youth hunting opportunities across the state. So, yeah, I'll put something on the website.
Senator Fairclough, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My point is I understand that we can't clarify every misinterpretation, mm-hmm. but if we have board members that are expressing concern about being asked about it, that if there's a way that is low cost and easy to clarify, that I certainly don't want you to invest $75,000 to try to interpret regulations like that, but if there's a bulletin that we can put out that helps your board members, I would hope that we would do something. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, and if this passes, it would be my intent to have this conversation with the board, after this and tell them that this was the intent, that it doesn't require them, but just requires us to consider bringing youth hunt opportunities forward. And if I could just add one last thing, one of my personal, commitments that I made when I took this job is to make sure our hunting heritage is passed on. So we are actively looking at those opportunities as we go through the last couple board cycles and providing those back to our board, because we got to pass this on for future generations.
Good. Senator Bishop.
I just had a comment, maybe bring a little levity to the discussion. Doug, you visit with your peers in the lower 48, right?
Yes.
I might not be accurate on this, so I want you to fact check what I'm going to say. It used to be my understanding that the state of Pennsylvania just took the whole week off and took everybody hunting, kids, family, and the whole ball of wax. Is that right?
Well, I have heard that. I haven't fact checked it, but there are many other states that actually there's a state law that says that it's an excused absence from school to go and participate in a youth hunt. So there's a wide range of these hunting opportunities across the lower 48.
Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, on the website, and I can back out a little bit, and I don't expect you to know every tab on your website. There are hundreds of them. But there is a youth program site. It talks about some of the training, Youth Hunter Education Challenge, some of the different leagues, youth conservation camps, and at the bottom is a youth small game hunts. It's kind of a different thing, but it's one of the reasons I became interested in this law, aside from Ted Spraker being sort of a little bit of my hero, but my only teen girl, Madeline, of course you all know her, but she was a member of Teens on Target. It was put on by Ted and Elena. One of the things they did was a couple of these youth small game hunts, but the other was they actually, the young girls, the ages were probably 14 to 16, went out on a youth moose hunt. It was one of these hunts, actually, and it was an antlerless moose. They learned about responsible hunting and firearm safety, proper stalking, proper butchering and care techniques, and You know, we spend a lot of time, the Michikis spend a lot of time together outdoors as a family, but sometimes when they get in those teen years, they don't want to hang out with Dad quite as much. And the experience was extremely positive and got Madeline very interested in hunting again in Alaska. So anything that I could do reasonably and responsibly to help with that process was my interest in this bill.
Great. Any further discussion of the bill? That completed public testimony, so I'll close public testimony. No further discussion. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 77, version 28-LSO630/A, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Very good. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 77, version A, with a zero fiscal note and individual recommendations, will pass out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the transmittal documents. We're back on the record. Last item on our agenda today should be very interesting. It's Chinook Salmon Research Initiative Overview and Update. So joining us, Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks and Ed Jones, Chinook Initiative Coordinator from the Department of Fish and Game. So welcome, gentlemen, if you'd put yourself on your on the record and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game. With me is our project coordinator, Ed Jones. I thought I'd start out, go through the first few slides, give you a general overview, and then turn it over to Mr. Jones for a little bit more detail. He's our Chinook expert and is anxious to share his knowledge with you. Starting out, we have a $30 million five-year initiative is what we've proposed in FY14. $7.5 million was appropriated towards as the first component of the initiative. In SB 119, the FY or 2015 request, there's another $10 million installment requested. It's under before you for consideration now. The focus of the initiative is to conduct research on the causes of decline in Chinook salmon that's occurring statewide. We've identified 12 indicator stocks from the Yukon all the way to the southeast Alaska where we propose to do work, and each of them is unique and was carefully chosen for the contributions that we can get from additional research. We're going to be conducting a multifaceted, comprehensive work on the life cycle, trying to identify where in the life cycle the effects are occurring from mortality that are affecting productivity and low abundance. That work will include adult and juvenile work. We're going to be doing genetics work, coded wire tagging, local and traditional knowledge, and looking at subsistence harvest patterns. The initiative also includes about 10% of the overall project will be RSA to the university for research projects that they have, so we're working cooperatively and collaboratively with them as well. Each of the bodies of the department as well as the university brings a unique skill set, so we're taking advantage of those where they exist. We've also conducted a bit of outreach, reaching out to NGOs and other parties that can partner with us to accomplish some of this work. So it's going to be multifaceted with many partners. We're going to talk about a lot of these things, but we also wanted to point out to you that at our website, highlighted on our homepage, is a Chinook Initiative webpage that gives all the much of the detail we're talking about, as well as a lot more, and goes into greater detail. So that's an ongoing resource for the members. These next two slides, it's kind of hard to read, at least on the slide up there. We had some color on the original slides, but it's just to give you an idea of the 12 river systems and what we intend to do in this one for adult work as well as juvenile work over a five-year period, and it lines it out in that manner. Some of the other projects that we'll be doing: marine sampling, the LTK work that I talked to you about, local and traditional knowledge, genetics work, coded wire tagging, and so forth are also listed over the five-year life of the project with totals by year and by type of project. So it gives you some context for the types of things that we'll be doing. I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that this project is complementing the work that's already being done by the department. Just in 2013, we've initiated a lot of work on weirs, on sonars, and genetics to help us identify some of the causes of the declines in Chinook. Another thing that we wanted to point out in a general way is that this isn't intended to be a five-year study culminating in a report. As we get knowledge that's helpful to us in managing fisheries and advising the boards on allocation decisions, we're going to use that as soon as it becomes available, because ultimately our goal is to provide harvest opportunity for Alaskans, for the folks out there using the resources. And so any improvements that we can make on our assessments help us to be more precise in our management and in the information we provide to the boards in providing harvest opportunity to Alaskans. We also have a couple other things that we are focusing on. The legislature provided us with funds for doing enhancement work, and so where we can, we're enhancing fish populations through our hatcheries. And then we're also working with the boards to, where we do have abundant stocks, chum and sockeye and coho, we're trying to provide opportunities so that while Chinook is undergoing a low cycle, there still are other species of salmon that can be harvested, and we're trying to take best of, advantage of those that we can. So with those general comments, I think it's time for me to hand it off to Mr. Jones, and I'm happy to field questions, or we can certainly answer those anytime throughout the presentation.
Madam Chair?
Sure. Senator French, one second. I have a couple finance members and myself that have to be leaving at 5, so just FYI. Senator French.
Just on that last slide, Madam Chair, there were a list of, it looked like initiative aspects that I was just curious about, and most of them relate to the gathering, I suppose, of traditional knowledge. And I just wanted to know, you got them divided up by river and by area. I just wanted to know what that process is going to look like, or maybe tell me more about it. Maybe I'm making a wrong assumption. Just tell me what the traditional knowledge aspect of each of those lines refers to and how it will work.
Through the chair and Senator French, that would be our subsistence division going out into those communities, interviewing folks. We have a survey instrument that we use to identify harvest patterns and that kind of thing, and really getting knowledge, because we can do it from a biological standpoint, but there's a lot of local knowledge there that can fill in gaps on run strength and, you know, historical levels and size of fish and things like that. So it's that kind of information.
So a face-to-face interview, a tape-recorded interview, how is the information captured and then acted on?
Through the chair, Senator French. In many cases, face-to-face. We also employ local residents to assist us in the effort. We have a survey instrument that we use, that the division uses as a matter of course. So it'll be a combination of those kinds of things.
I mean, it sounds to me, if I could just, Madam Chair, it sounds to me like you could make a fascinating historical document. At some time to have gathered that information. I don't know if it's being tape recorded or not, but I can just see some historian 20, 30, 40 years from now would love to pore over those records and see what folks thought at the time about what the salmon runs were like and what they were doing and what they'd been like in their memories.
Through the chair, Senator French, I appreciate the comments. I do know that we do document the efforts of the division. It's maintained in our database and made available on our website. So,
yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. I'll let you proceed.
Madam Chair, I have one question.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Machiki.
Thank you. Before we move on through the chair, page 3 of the 12 primary Chinook rivers in Alaska, which are not suffering from low, currently suffering from low abundance?
I might as well introduce myself. I'm Ed Jones. I'm a fish and game coordinator with the Division of Sport Fish in the Douglas Regional Office. And through the chair, Senator Machiki. Sorry, I've never met you before, but I'm
perfect. Nice to meet you.
Anyway. Were you wondering what system out of the 12 indicators is not suffering pork production right now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in general, all 12 of them are suffering. Now, the Nooshigak appears to be doing better than most, but I think that's also a function of the stock assessment program we have in place. So this is a widespread event. It's basically ranging from southern British Columbia all the way to the Yukon. So there are a few outliers, but in the 12 indicator stocks, in general, they're all suffering from this. So,
follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just that your work is imperative. Alaskans are spending a lot of time pointing fingers at each other when obviously we have a statewide issue. So I think it's imperative that we understand the issues causing low abundance and anything that I can help or this legislature can help to understand those issues and impacts, I think, are imperative. Thanks for your work.
Well, I'll go through my notes here and proceed. As everyone is well aware, we're suffering some severe declines in Chinook productivity and abundance, and this obviously has caused social and economic hardships across the state. And this Chinook Research Initiative is an investment to address the critical knowledge gaps that limit management capabilities. Through this initiative, we will gather the information necessary to assist managers with more accurate and timely measures of productivity, ultimately improving management confidence and thus affording increased fishing opportunities when possible. This year we have we have 35 Chinook salmon research initiative projects going into the water. We received detailed operational plans for all 35 of them, and since the fall, staff have been meeting and going through these plans to fine-tune the methods and objectives.
Great, Kevin.
We recognize that there is a fundamental need to more precisely characterize Chinook salmon productivity and abundance across the state, and to gather the information necessary to understand the root causes of these widespread declines and to fill these knowledge gaps.
Good. I'll do it.
There we go. This might be easier, except I have my hand on your notes, Kevin. In 2012, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game created the Chinook Salmon Research Team. And the department hosted a symposium in mid-October of 2012 to provide information on Chinook salmon declines and to provide perspectives on relevant research and management needs. The main focus of the symposium was to identify key knowledge gaps and assemble a list of priorities to address specific questions pertaining to Chinook salmon abundance and productivity in the state. Over 450 shareholders or stakeholders attended the symposium in person, over the phone, and via the internet, and all presentations and panelists' discussions, as well as comments and questions received from stakeholders, were used by the research team as an aid in developing a special publication 13-01. And this publication is titled The Chinook Salmon Stock Assessment and Research Plan 2013, and it's available on our website. And this plan was developed to guide our efforts towards a better understanding of Chinook salmon productivity and abundance in the state. So for nearly a decade now, as you can see in this figure, Alaska and British Columbia, for that matter, have been suffering from poor production. The last time Alaska had production at this level, this poor level, was nearly four decades ago in the late 60s and early 70s. This research plan documents these stock-specific declines in production and points out the gaps in knowledge that impair our management. The plan also describes the general life history of Chinook salmon in the state, makes recommendations for research, and provides guidance on funding. But the core of the plan is a stock-specific, life history-based approach to research that focuses on the 12 indicator stocks from around the state that represent diverse life histories and migratory characteristics over a broad geographic range. As part of this initiative this year, projects to estimate Chinook salmon adult spawning abundance will occur in 9 of the 12 indicator stocks, and that will cost about $1.8 million. Juvenile abundance work will also take place in 8 of the 12 indicator stocks, and that will total about $670,000. We have detailed marine sampling programs going in the water in three areas, and that's going to total about $350,000. And subsistence work will take place in 8 of the indicator stocks. Now, these subsistence projects are designed to study the local and traditional knowledge, or LTK, of Chinook salmon subsistence fishers. These subsistence projects also are designed to study the patterns and trends in subsistence fishing, and to estimate the actual in-season harvest due to subsistence fishing. In total, this subsistence work will cost about $620,000 this fiscal year. Another $850,000 is allocated to ADF&G for Chinook salmon genetic baseline and marker development, programmatic support, and to the University of Alaska Fairbanks for process and growth studies. In total, this fiscal year, $4.4 million will be spent specific to the Chinook Salmon Research Initiative. Now I'll get a little detailed on I'll go into each of the indicator stocks, but starting in the north, in AYK, we obviously have the Yukon and the Kuskokwim. And then in Bristol Bay, we're representing Bristol Bay with the Nooshigak system. And on the Alaska Peninsula, we have the Chignik. And on Kodiak Island, we have the Karluk. In Upper Cook Inlet, we have the Susitna and Kenai. And near Prince William Sound, we have the Copper River. And in Southeast Alaska, we have the Chilkat, the Taku, the Stikine, and the Yunik Rivers. Now, the Yukon River is obviously our largest watershed that we're going to work on. It's transboundary in nature, meaning that we work cooperatively with Canada on this project to manage the stock of Chinook. And our plan is to perform both adult and juvenile work. And in addition to three subsistence projects that will take place, the adult work right now, we've tabled it till next fiscal year. We're doing juvenile work this year, and we're doing the three subsistence projects this year. So it's a little bit cumbersome as we move through these. I'll try to make it as smooth and quick as possible, but if you have any questions, just get me after. The Kuskokwim River will implement a marker capture study to estimate the adult spawning abundance this year, and at the same time we'll also do the three subsistence projects. Next fiscal year we're going to start the juvenile work. And on the Nooshiegak River, we're going to perform both the adult and juvenile work this year and a subsistence LTK project. The juvenile work is going to be a feasibility study this year, but the adult work is going to be at full capacity, and it'll use a marker capture study. Now, the Chignik River on the peninsula, we're going to use a weir to estimate adult abundance, and we're implementing a detailed marine sampling program to gather genetics and, you know, harvest information, Dakota wire tag recovery information. And there's also going to be a subsistence LTK and harvest study. They're rolled together in this case. And that's taking place this fiscal year. And on the Karlik, there's a weir there to estimate abundance as well. And we're also going to implement a juvenile abundance program on the Karlik. And in addition, there's a detailed marine sampling program that's going in the water this year.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator French.
Can we just get a word or two about how the weir works? You mentioned the weir a couple times about using that to get your abundance number. Are you just physically, I mean, just tell me how that works.
Through the Chair, Senator French, the weir is a total fish enumeration. What they'll do is it's completely blocked off with pickets or other means. In this case, I think they actually use PVC pipes, if not metal pickets. And they'll pull a couple of those pickets and actually count fish across a counting platform. So they're counting individual fish as they go over that platform.
So you choke the fish, you choke the river down to basically one or two fish width, and then you can physically count every single fish that goes through there.
That's correct.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. A lot of work.
And at the same time,
24 hours? I mean, how does that...
Well, through the chair, Senator French, the typical operation would be to hold fish up during the day. The fish tend to not move during daylight hours. They're pretty shy. Now, when the runs are really coming in, they will. But so oftentimes, weir operations, the crews start up about 10 or 11 o'clock at night and work till, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning. And, you know, they'll turn lights on and pull pickets and count fish. At the same time, they'll have a capture device to where they can subsample the population for age, sex, and length information and tag information.
Kind of sounds like fun.
Through the chair, Senator French, it can be fun. It can also be a lot of work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead and proceed.
So on the in Cook Inlet, we've got the Susitna River. And in that river, we're going to do a juvenile and adult abundance project funded through this initiative, but that work will begin in FY15. This year, we are actually funding a detailed marine sampling program through the initiative in Upper Cook Inlet. But the adult work is already in the water, and it's funded under a separate CIP. So it's already ahead of the game. It's in the water, and we're going to take over funding next year. There's also a subsistence LTK study that's being funded right now through the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund. So, and on the Kenai River, the Chinook Initiative is funding a subsistence LTK study, which is already underway, and a separate CIP is covering the adult abundance work. But next year, the Chinook Initiative will take over both the adult and the juvenile aspects of this work.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Are there still any netting programs for studying abundance in the Kenai River? What is your primary method in that system?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the current program right now, as you know, you're well familiar with it. I know now we're phasing the original sonar technique upriver to mile 13, and the practice with that sonar is to not only enumerate Chinook salmon with the sonar, but to also subsample the population through a netting program to get a size and age breakdown of those fish. So that's the current practice. It's the same method that's been going on for years. We've adjusted things because we're changing our sonar location, and with that there's a few things that have, you know, we're working around, but there is netting still going on. It's you have to have a subsample of the population to accurately describe the size and age of these fish. So
good follow up, Senator Machiki.
Just a suggestion for it's just something the department may consider. You have a lot of senators and representatives in this building that may not understand sort of some of the impacts on the river systems that are available on the road system. And while you're doing some operations, I know you want to keep us out of the way, but if there's ever the opportunity to educate legislators on the river by observing some of those operations, I think it would be extremely helpful for them to understand sort of what's going on and what you do every day.
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, you are invited, cordially invited, to come out and participate. Although you can't use you're familiar with drift gear, I believe. anyway,
is he the only one invited?
No. No.
And Madam Chair, actually, if I may follow up on that, last year I think there was a lot of interest in our new sonar site, and we actually did do some tours where we had folks in and observing how that actually takes place, and I think the interest was certainly high, and the point is well taken, so we'll look for those opportunities.
Great. Go ahead and proceed.
Okay, moving on to the Copper River near Prince William Sound. The Chinook Initiative is going to fund an adult marker capture study and a juvenile abundance study this season. In addition to that, we have a detailed marine sampling program and a subsistence LTK project going in the water this year.
Madam Chair, can we just go back one
slide? Senator French.
I'm going to have to say something about that slide. No, back to the Copper River.
Okay.
Did we just give up Alaska to Canada, or what happened there? Am I missing something? Am I the only one that's noticed that? Do I have to do this?
Through the chair, Senator French, I blame that on Ben Mulligan.
Fair enough.
He's actually not responsible for that. I'm just joking. I know who is, but we'll get that fixed.
Okay.
And it's amazing how you miss those things.
You can tell him I noticed.
Well, I looked at that slide 100 times and didn't notice it, so.
Just don't want you to keep sleeping up here.
Yep. No, I want that corrected, actually, because I work on the SAMI Commission, and I don't want to maybe present that and have them backfire on me. Anyway.
Great catch.
That sounds right.
And on the Chilcat River near Haines, we're going to do both adult and juvenile work this season, as well as an LTK study. And this is a long-term ongoing project that is now being taken over, supplemented through the Chinook Initiative. There's still some base level funding that it takes place on this river. And the same holds true for the other three projects in Southeast. The Taku River, we're doing adult and juvenile abundance work. And on the Stikine River, we're doing adult and juvenile, as well as a local and traditional knowledge study. And it's important to note that the Taku and Stikine Rivers are transboundary rivers, and they fall under the purview of the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and the managers work together between the two countries. And then in far southern southeast, the Unic River, and we're going to do adult and juvenile work this season, funded under the Chinook Initiative. And finally, a chance to provide some key points here. The primary objective of this work is to increase our confidence in estimates of adult spawning abundance, especially in the face of this poor production. First and foremost, we have to accurately estimate how many fish are actually getting on the spawning grounds. And there's, to be honest, quite a few holes in our program that this is going to help shore up. The detailed marine sampling programs are designed to estimate stock-specific harvests, among other things. And this is ultimately accomplished through genetic stock ID and coded wire tag sampling programs. And this information is used to improve run and reconstruction, and it benefits abundance-based management. So this is how we get out into the mixed stock fishery and actually estimate how many of certain stock are actually being harvested by the various fisheries. So this is our tool. And then to bring this all home and give some examples here, when you add a juvenile abundance program on top of an adult abundance program, you can then estimate marine survival. And marine survival is a huge piece of information that's currently only available for 4 of the 12 indicator stocks, and those are all in Southeast Alaska. And those programs began in the early 90s, the Chilcat later in the 90s. But we've had stock assessment programs for Chinook salmon since the early 70s that provided consistent measures of abundance. So the programs in Southeast, and you know, I work with the Southern U.S. and the Canadians through the treaty. It's well known that the Southeast Stock Assessment Program leads by example. And what we're hoping is to let some of this, you know, experience and knowledge spread its way north to the rest of the state. And that's what we're doing that in part here. And just as an example how beneficial such a program can be, the information we've obtained from the Southeast stocks has shown marine survival during the current period of pork production has essentially dropped from our usual 2-4% to basically about 1%. So that being said, for every 100 juveniles that go into the ocean, we used to get 2-4 adults back. This is for Chinook salmon. Now we're getting back about 1. And some might ask, well, maybe that's the freshwater environment. Well, we actually estimate the juvenile abundance in these systems. And we've seen the abundance of juveniles has been average to above average during this period of time. So we know it's happening in the marine environment. Where and why, we don't know. But we've at least pinned it to that in this case for the 4 Southeast stocks. Through this initiative, we're going to be able to do similar work up around the corner all the way to the Nooshigak, maybe all the way to the Yukon with the juveniles. So, and in closing, now that things are starting to come together, we're really going to start to focus on the outreach and collaborative research aspects of this work. It's my experience, if you don't have the locals on board with what you're doing out on the river, you're not going to get very far. So it's a big push we have right now, and it's something that it's high on our priority, so high priority for us. So with that, I'll entertain any questions. And that was a little bit of a jumbled presentation, but hopefully I inspired some questions. So.
Great. It was very good. Questions? Senator Dyson?
Somebody else has got a question right on target. I'll defer mine slightly off.
All right. Senator Machicki.
I have a couple questions. Other than bycatch folks that are discarding Chinook, I think every user group is equally important in the state. I represent a district with 36,000 Alaskans. Every one of them are a fisheries biologist, as you know, and we've got a whole bunch of them in this state. But your last statement, I think, is extremely important. Part of this initiative absolutely has to be the education of Alaskans. And one of the reasons that's so incredibly important is they're looking for relief today, now. And the way Alaskans find relief today is at the expense of their neighbors. And I'm talking about everywhere from, I feel like I represent everywhere from, Matsu Lodge owners to Eastside Set Netters to subsistence users on the Yukon. They're all important. But what is your plan for educating Alaskans so they stop taking it out on each other? And to try to understand that these are often systemic, oceanic, atmospheric issues that are not going to solve themselves today, and may take some time to get some get back to where we have adequate abundance in our Chinook runs.
Well, through the chair and Senator Michicki, I think maybe both of us can take a swipe at this one, but obviously circumstances vary by river system, and where you have a river that's 100% allocated, it certainly creates a different dynamic with the users. And it does come down to information and getting education to the folks so that they're informed on this, because there's a lot of different causes, and that's why we're taking such a comprehensive approach to try and get at it. We've heard it, Commissioner Campbell's on the North Pacific Council, and she hears about the bycatch issue quite often. And one of the things that really resonated with me was if you can pinpoint 12,000 fish that are being caught in a bycatch scenario, and that's a significant number, it doesn't explain why 200,000 fish didn't show up in the river.
Sure.
It's certainly contributing, but putting it in a context that folks can understand. And then from our perspective, trying to provide opportunity on other stocks that are abundant while we work through and try and understand some of the contributing factors to the decline of Chinook stocks. So that would be my lead, and Ed probably has something he might like to contribute on this as well. But.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Through the chair, Senator Michicki. We're making some efforts to get publications out. We're implementing a fish facts program, and that's going to be, in this case, it's going to be a Chinook facts, and that will soon come out. It's like a newsletter that's going to be available on the web and hard copies. But there's a lot of other examples. For instance, right now we need to get some information, be a little proactive about what's fixing to happen in Southeast Alaska, because just to familiarize folks with the way things work down here, the fisheries are covered under the treaty. Well, every spring, and in this case late March of this year, we're going to come out with an abundance index that is a measure of the abundance of Chinook salmon passing by the waters of Southeast Alaska. Well, the indicators right now is that number is going to be very high this year, very high. And the reason being is because although British Columbia and Southeast or in Alaska have been in a period of poor production, Washington, Oregon, California have been experiencing the opposite. And their numbers are off the chart right now. They're setting records in many areas. So when you go out fishing off Sitka this year, there's going to be an awful lot of Chinook salmon to be caught. So when we have, and we're going to have regulations that are designed to catch those fish. And fisheries are going to be more aggressive to do so under the treaty. But that backfires in most people's mind, given the fact that we're in a period of poor production. Well, we need to get the word out on the street that although we are in a period of poor production up here, the stocks we're catching off the coast in Southeast are southern-bound stocks for the most part. So we can be a little more aggressive. So we need to let people understand the relationship, and that's just an example of getting the word out. And there's other examples, but I agree. It's a pet peeve that I have that folks just simply don't understand. And it'd be nice to sit down with them and explain, kind of like we're doing here, and sit down and discuss these different behaviors that we know. I mean, there's a lot of folks that work with Chinook salmon that have a lot of really neat information. And it's just, the opportunity to get the word out is not there all the time. And I think it would be proactive on our part to do so. It'd go a long way to helping some of these inter-fishery strife,
Senator Michicki, to follow up?
You kind of led into my next one perfectly, and that is we watch those stocks crash, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, California.
British Columbia.
Right. My impression, correct me if I'm wrong, which my wife will tell you I often am, we don't understand why they crashed. don't understand why they came back. How do we understand those oceanic issues without adequate funding for offshore research to understand? And maybe, like I said, I could be wrong. Maybe they know exactly what caused those crashes 10 years ago and understand why they're back, but that's just my impression.
Through the chair, Senator Machichi, I think that it's important for folks to understand that we have a pretty good control over what happens in our freshwater environment. But once you get out in the marine environment, even if we did know what was going on, say the ocean was at a warmer temperature than it ever was before, I don't know how you're going to solve the problem. So my idea behind all this is you narrow the scope, you pin down the areas where it might be happening, and then you look at whether or not you can do anything about it. But more than likely, the marine environment, it's pretty much out of your hands in that regard. Now, Alaska is very unique in that we still have our habitat. So our freshwater environment, stands alone on the West Coast. You know, we are ahead of the game in that regard. As long as we protect that freshwater environment, we're going to be ahead of the game. What happens in the marine, though, is really out of our control. So,
just a quick follow-up. I'm sorry. So again, my assumption is correct. They don't understand what happened in those British Columbia and those three states, and they're just celebrating the return of those stocks.
Through the chair, Senator Machichi, the one thing that I can say. That's kind of interesting information. I'm telling stories now. Let's look at an example. The Upper Columbia River stock of Chinook salmon, they essentially head out to the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea just like Taku River fish do. They go to the same part of the world to rear and grow up in the marine environment. For some reason, the Upper Columbia River stock of Chinook salmon is doing very well right now, whereas the Taku, on the flip side, is in a period of poor production. Now, that is information that we tend to believe that what that does is it narrows the scope down to the early marine, the first few months at sea. And for some reason, it's my opinion anyway, that those stocks are like the Columbia River, as an example, are going in the early marine and getting a head start. They're surviving at a higher rate for whatever reason. There's probably food availability. That might, you know, who knows what the real issue is, whereas the Taku, when they're going to the early marine, they're dying. That's where we think it's happening, is in the first few months. So they're going to the same neck of the woods. They're coming out of the freshwater in different areas. One stock surviving, and it's not just one stock. This is regionally, this is what's occurring right now, and we don't know the cause. Nobody really knows it. There's a bunch of theories. Or hypotheses, I should say. But what we can say is that generally the marine survival will work its way back north and it'll improve up here, and then what happens down south is the opposite. We tend to work in opposites. And the early indications through some of the stock composition information I've seen is that British Columbia and Southeast Alaska are producing more juveniles in the last year, and that's the first step in seeing this creep up the coast. So the next step would be to see that happen for Copper and Cook Inlet and westward in AYK. So
just a more basic question, just for our definitions, what do you how do you define a juvenile? What is a juvenile exactly in this presentation?
Through the chair, Senator French, and when I refer to juveniles, I'm essentially speaking to a fish that's still in the fresh water. Now, obviously, once they hit the marine environment, they're not necessarily mature fish, they're rearing fish. Some folks might consider those juveniles as well. And, you know, maybe for the first few months at sea, maybe they're considered juveniles. But in this case, for this presentation, freshwater referred to juveniles. Marine to adults.
Got it. Thanks. I'm done.
Senator Chiggy?
So, okay, you talked earlier about the last we've seen abundance issues in Alaska at this level of concern was the late 60s, early 70s. In your chart, it shows the max 73 to 75 being a full level of one standard deviation from the average run. That was the upper end of the run. Do we understand the issue then? Was that a catching issue, or was it an oceanic issue as well, or do we know?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the stock assessment programs that we had in place during the early 70s, late 60s, we had some in-river programs that were very good, at least indices of abundance, and we know that the production was very similar to what we're seeing now in those areas. We used catch as a surrogate in some cases for this trend analysis. There was different ways we came up with the runs for those earlier years because, you know, the programs weren't very strong back then. But some of them were, and in those strong programs, it was that was what was going on. It was a poor period of production. And, you know, there was fishing that was going on at higher levels than normal, but the difference you saw back then when the production was poor, we really didn't pull the reins back necessarily on our fishing. So not only did we have poor production, we had exploitation rates that were too high to support escapement. So that's what we've done here. We've done a good job of managing to get escapement in most cases. But with that, you have to, you know, curtail the fisheries. So
thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
could I just offer one additional comment? Thank you. And just in response to Senator Machicki's question on education, I think you may be familiar with the Moose News that we've done on the mm-hmm. on the peninsula. It's a newspaper format.
Excellent.
We have one in production for Chinook as well, and it's something that we hope to be able to distribute our area offices, get it out in people's hands, and give them that kind of basic knowledge, and then look at updating that in the fall after we've had a year at this, or, you know, the first season at this. So it's just looking at the tools to get that information out. And I know that Moose News was well received, and Wildlife is a little bit ahead of our fish divisions on that type of outreach. So we're looking to model that effort.
Mr. Chairman, I like the Moose News. I think it's an effective way to communicate. That's very good news. And of course, my goal is helping Alaskans understand they just may have to be patient. It could be a decade. And user group relationships, just simply, we can't afford to have them implode in the meantime. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
The issue of preservation or restoration of our own freshwater environment, certainly on the Susitna Flats, where I spend a lot of time, there's huge damage from beaver. And every meadow there, you can see the flyover, you can see the eyebrow like thing there where they built their dams to log off the area and so on. It choked off a lot of streams. So in talking to your guys in the area, they said, yeah, it's a huge problem. A lot of prime rearing ground has been lost. And then, of course, there's the issues of culverts. And I think in that area, they're making some progress on it. So I made a suggestion, I think, two times in writing to the department. What can we do about trapping out the beaver in the area where they're killing the fish streams and restoring the stream beds, you know, to something like their, what they were, you know, at a time before they were destroyed or degraded by the beaver? The answer I got back is, good idea, go away. Kind of. It's kind of a good idea, maybe it's not practical. So the problem with the beaver trapping is that it's not economic for trappers. Pelts aren't worth the effort. So I suggested, okay, can we do a bounty on them? You know, something like that. Because lots of people think of trapping as a really fun thing to do and a great thing to do with your kids. And I ask, do the people in fish, sport fish and commercial fish, communicate with the fish and game guys, the wildlife guys, when there is wildlife negatively impacted fish. And the answer is, yeah, well, we're just down the hall, or we talk to those guys and so on. But it does feel like it's a little bit of a silo sort of thing. And I can tell you that there's lots of citizens out there that would just be delighted to get involved in the restoration, both by trapping beaver and busting down dams. You know. And I realize that's a front-end loaded thing for you guys, just to even get it going. You know, you got to take people from other sorts of resources. So on. But back to what Senator Machicki has been saying, you know, getting the user groups part of the process and being able to cooperate has an unmeasurable, intangible benefit at some point. And I can't tell you that spending any time, money, or anything else on my wild idea is worth it or supersedes anything else you're doing. But it just makes so darn much sense, you know, to stop the destruction from the beaver and reclaim what we can reasonably, that I think it ought to be pursued. So I raised a lot of teenagers. I'm used to being ignored, and I won't be offended if I am on this issue. So there's no meeting Friday. We meet on Monday. The Mr. chair is up in Senate Finance where she has a bill.
Ben. Senator Dyson, for the record, Ben Mulligan, Legislative Liaison for Fish and Game. We actually just initiated a habitat assessment to go out into the Susitna River drainage to look at beaver dams and assess where they are a detriment, because in some areas, you know, for sockeye salmon, they can be a deterrent to their productivity, but in some ways, they're good for coho juveniles. So we actually will kick off, hopefully this season, looking at those and determining where we need to get rid of those beavers and those beaver dams, and then working with the Mat-Su Fish and Wildlife Commission and the Mat-Su Salmon Partnership on those future endeavors.
You'd win great points for pandering if you told me that my letters had something to do with
it. Well, it definitely spurred the conversation to get that ball rolling, sir.
Okay, thank you. We're adjourned.